Good morning. Aloha kaka hiaka. This is Maka'ala. This is Pilikia Opono, a concept developed by our esteemed Laura Christine, DJ, former GM, KKCR. She is willing to get up at the crack of freaking dawn to be here with us at the station so that those of you that are headed off for your day can have some food for thought about the difference between, or maybe not, the similarities between Hawaiians of old and what's happening today. Today especially, Mauna Kea Trask and I would like to talk about an issue hot on the front burner for most of us. And even us little guys here on Kauai have been kind of hit with it. So we're not going to give it its nasty, nasty government names, but we are going to talk about immigration. We invite your calls, 808-826-7771. Give us a chance to get started and lay some stuff out and then call with comments or questions. We welcome the always, welcome them always. And thank KKCR for allowing this opportunity to exist repeatedly and occur. So good morning. I hope you're having a good morning. I'm so happy that we're finally getting sunshine in the morning a little bit. This getting up in the crack of dark is not my favorite thing. Happy to see spring coming, even with the wet. Good morning, Mauna. How are you?
Hey, good morning. I'm doing well. Well, Laura. Well, hi, everyone.
Good morning.
Bom dia.
Bom dia. Yeah. So, okay. Mauna gave this some thought, and I certainly agree that this is a timely topic. And I'm just going to let him roll with it because I know Zipola about the early immigration philosophies, thoughts, responses, promotions of immigration between the time when the Polynesians first got here and when the sugar companies needed immigrants to help them do their work. So there's a big blank hole in my knowledge base, and Mauna's hopefully going to try to plug that up a little bit for me and maybe for you too. So good morning, Mauna. I'm just going to give you the reins and let you go because I don't know this stuff.
Okay. Let's get political. So, you know, I was looking at the KKCR website and looking at what it says. We have a lot of shows, but aside from that, like, the premise of this show is to look at what Hawaiian culture and Hawaiian traditions would say about various things. And so in looking at that, I thought, kind of bringing it back to that, immigration being a very interesting hot button issue, what did Hawaiians think of it? And I think in short, it was similar to today, but at the same time, I think they accepted it much more in general. And I don't think a lot of the modern concerns were shared with the Hawaiians, just because Polynesians in general, and they were voyagers, right? I mean, that was their whole thing.
They were the immigrants.
Yeah, they were all, and Mary Kawenapuhui references Hawaiians as colonizers. They were the colonizers of Hawaii. And in looking at everything now and the issues that people deal with as far as, you know, the colonizer label or immigrants and everything, I think it was much more, it was seen as a natural part of the process. Not, you know, I mean, you just go look at the beach. It's essentially, the history of Hawaii is essentially shown on the beaches, which is driftwood comes in and out, and you have these varying migrations of material. Some stuff stays, some stuff doesn't. some coconuts take root. Some are just big dead logs from the northwest. You know, who knows? But definitely been happening for, you know, 1,000 years about. And not without political contention. You had different material cultures and migrations and governmental and chief, structures. You had the Nanaula chiefs first, who were later supplanted with the Pili chiefs that came with Pa'al in the 1100s. And there was some political turmoil then, but ultimately, whoever provided anyone with the better life is who ran Hawaii. And I think that still rings true, so that's it.
Yeah, it's interesting. We started, you know, one of the issues that just won't go away, the Iwi in Haena, Wainiha. And last year I was on site of where they had discovered some Iwi, and two of the archaeologists that I respect happened to be there that day. And I really didn't know they were going to be there anyway. And they started talking about some of the things that they were digging up, that they were discovering, that were being exposed in the process of the development there. And an awful lot of it was Chinese porcelain. And I was surprised by that. My husband and I, years and years and years ago, used to pick up quite a bit of blue and white porcelain in Kalihiwai. Don't see it anymore, but there must have been something that got revealed. And it started me thinking, you know, how did that begin? Did they get invited because... Did they get invited by the Hawaiians? Did they get invited by the white men? Did they get invited by the plantation owners? Did they get invited at all? Did they just show up as an opportunist, a little bit like the gold rush in California? Did they just come as an opportunity? And more recently, the Hanalei Initiative has done something really cool, I think, with support from the county and others. They started looking at the Chinese immigration. They started looking at the Chinese history in Hanalei. And if you ask my husband, and most Hawaiians I know, the cemetery up Ohiki Road is called Hanalei Mauka. That's the Hanalei Mauka Cemetery, and a lot of Hawaiians are buried there. But historically, it was a Chinese cemetery. I was talking to people that know this stuff and people that have studied this stuff, including local people. We always called it Hanalei Mauka. We never called it the Chinese cemetery, but the Chinese people always called it the Chinese cemetery. So I never knew that. I knew there was a mix of people buried there. And, you know, cemeteries are an amazing source of historical information, right? But in modern day. So what I'm interested in is before that. Did immigrants just show up here, or were they elicited? Were they sought? Or did they just bump into the rock by accident?
Yeah, well, I think, and forgive me, I'm not up on the dates specifically. So I'm happy to be corrected. And by all means, everybody, go out and read. Do your own, I don't want to say do your own research, because that's kind of like a weird statement now, but go do the reading, read the books. And I think the first Chinese immigrants show up in the 1850s. So that would have been some period between Kamehameha III and IV. And they were brought in for labor. You know, Hawaiians were decimated by disease at that point. Just a lot of stuff going down, and you had sugar coming up, various types of ag being tested. And I think the Chinese came to Hanalei first, North Shore first. You had Titcomb trying to do coffee, and they're trying to grow silk, so maybe that had to do something with it. Hard to do. Ag is difficult in Hawaii, as we all know. But, yeah, so you start seeing that, and I'm assuming Ching Yong is Chinese. I've always thought that. So you have going way back, even Hayanahui, Wainihahui records, you have Chinese, and they came to labor. And you had, you know, one of the arguments on the brilliance and sophistication of the Hawaiian Kingdom in the 19th century was that, you know, some people call it assimilation or whatever, but I really think Hawaiians, their culture acknowledges and takes the best out of everything while maintaining their own practices and identity as far as it works in the environment in Hawaii. And so they brought over laborers to go help do the work. And that's where you see them come in. And back then it was, you know, maybe some sent for brides, but mostly it was single guys. And then you see all these wahinis around and stuff happens, man. Can't help it.
It's nature at its best. When I was a young girl, I was living in the Marianas, and there was a need for laborers, and they brought in Filipinos. And they intentionally brought in single male Filipinos because they just didn't want to have to set up housekeeping and do accommodations for families, etc. So they solicited bachelors, and bachelors came, and they worked hard. But they were lonely. They were by themselves. And they actually had to fence them in. I remember the laborers' compounds, these huge high chain, of course, I was little, so maybe they weren't so high, but high chain link fences with like the razor wire on top. It looked like a concentration camp as far as I was concerned. But they provided the labor, but they didn't assimilate that well because they were so separated and segregated. But had it not been for that compound and that living arrangement, they probably would have been absorbed into the society fairly quickly. So I grew up being taken care of by a Filipino woman who had escaped the Philippines from an abusive domestic situation. She lived with us for many years, and I was raised with her son, who was older than me, and with Filipino food. And I don't remember a time when, and I'm nearly 80, I do not remember a time when there wasn't Chinese food or there wasn't Filipino food in that part of the world. And that's usually indicative of the fact that the people are there. And the Hawaiians would go, you know, cook their own, of course, but when a special occasion, they'd go out and they'd have Chinese or they'd have Filipino food. My husband today loves Filipino food. So, you know,
My grandfather loved Chinese food too.
Yeah. And you know, there's a funny little link to that. It has little to do with Hawaii, but it is a historical fact, and it's current today, that on a lot of our Christian holidays, such as Christmas, the Jewish people will hunt up a Chinese food restaurant. That's very common. New York City, all over the country, that's what they're looking for.
Because they're open, right?
Yeah, because they're open. That's right, because it's a different faith, and so they're open. They're not shut. And a lot of the food that I see, I look at how people eat, and a lot of the food we eat today has a Chinese base. My husband thinks it's Hawaiian food, and I keep saying it really isn't, honey. It really isn't. It's really, you know, sweet sour pork is Chinese. Saimin is not Hawaiian.
That's the main thing, right? I think Chinese, the only people who love pork as much as the Chinese is the Hawaiians.
Yeah. They just cooked it differently. Yeah, it's true, too. Well, and maybe me. I'm a big fan. But So immigration was, at least as far as the Hawaiians were concerned, because of disease and because their people, their numbers were diminishing because of disease mostly. But the rumor, you know, the myth is that they had to bring in all these workers because the Hawaiians were too lazy and they wouldn't work that hard. And I know from talking to Gary Smith and Kilauea and Kilauea Sugar Company, that certainly wasn't true there. He had a lot of immigrants there. They separated. That's an interesting place, you know, if you really look at the history of Kilauea, because they kind of separated them, you know. The Filipinos lived over there, and Hawaiians lived over there, and the Chinese lived over there. But they all got together all the time. Never quite understood the purpose of them having separate places. In the Lihue Cemetery, which many people don't even know where it is, there's absolutely lines of demarcation. If you're Chinese, you're over there. If you're Filipino, you're over there. And you can see the separation. But it wasn't one of disrespect. It wasn't that you're lesser than or you're different than. It was that those are your people and you go with your people. I don't know how that relates today, where we're trying to mix everybody up, you know, put everybody together. I don't know if it's working or not, but in those days, they really didn't try much. Socially, they'd get together, yeah?
Well, I think, yeah, so I a couple of things, and it's not really clear as far as I can tell, but I think the Hawaiians were maybe deemed too lazy to work the plantations or something, and I think that's definitely out there. But I've also seen stuff, and I'm paraphrasing, that suggests that the Hawaiians they're just kind of over it. They weren't into it. They had embraced this new life, and the kings. You know, Kawakili famously proclaimed he wanted his nation to be one of letters. And the Hawaiians are getting educated. And, they, you know, my great-grandfather, kind of put himself through school. You had all these Hawaiians aspiring to do these things. You had agriculturalists and people going away to go study in Italy, like Robert Wilcox. And so you had this kind of trend where it seems like Hawaiians, I mean, obviously, they didn't see themselves as contract laborers or effectively indentured servants. And their numbers were so low, the sugarcane companies at that time, they were importing large masses of people, you know, via contracts with other countries. And it's really interesting. The Japanese came later. There's Japanese here and there, but really the big migration and like the kind of Japanese labor that was seen in the later 19th century was during Kalakaua. And at one point, it's interesting, if you read Kaikendal, I think it's like Hawaiian History Volume 2, they talk about this, where at one point Kalakaua had, you know, advisors from all over the world, and he had some British guys and some American guys, and there was a rift between them for obvious reasons. But at one point, they talk about when Kalakaua toured the world, he went to India. And they were saying, you know, the British advisors that he had, as I recall, were suggesting get Indians. You know, that's what they were familiar with. That's who had worked their colonies. And then Kalakaua went to Japan. He was seeking this kind of Asia-Pacific Oceanic Empire arrangement. And he saw that the emperor of Japan could sit at the top. And he was really impressed by the Japanese, their culture. He saw a lot of similarities as far as, you know, the Hawaiian culture and them and their deference and respect of their emperor as compared to Hawaiian's respect for their ali'i. And so ultimately he went with them. But, I mean, imagine, you know, the currents of history if Kalakaua said, I want to get some, you know, Indians from India. Hawaii would have been totally different.
It looked like Fiji.
You know, yeah, Sog Paneer would be. Instead of Musubis or whatever, so
we look like Fiji. I think you know, it's interesting because when I was in Fiji, the Fijians own the land, but the Indians have all the money. They have the commerce. They did have, this was a number of years back. They had all the commerce. You know, they were brought in to do stuff, but they smart, huh? And they have the shops, they have the financial part of it, but the Fijians own the land. So that's
yeah, interesting.
Yeah, it's a different scenario.
There seems to be kind of a, I don't know if it's a law or something, but there's some kind of, and you see it, well, I don't know, I may be making this up, but I kind of see it with like introduced plants
uh-huh.
and other types of species. Like you can bring a plant from, you know, like mangrove is kept in check, wherever that's from, and it just goes nuts in Hawaii. And you have these migrations of people that come to Hawaii and they get established. And I can't, you know, I got my my godfather, he's Chinese, and his mother came from China in the mid 20th century. It was, and she left. She fled, I understand, during the Japanese invasion and stuff. And this wahine, on a waitress's salary, was able to put all her kids through school. Everyone has postgraduate degrees, bought two houses in Honolulu, has a rental in Eva, and like just so crazy. And then sometimes I think like, wow, I have like a 1,000-year head start on these people. it blew us away. But in any event, so immigration. But the interesting thing is it's not just, and I want to mention this, it's not just in the 1800s or post-contact where you see immigration in Hawaii. Again, you look at the myths and legends, and not only do we see different waves of Austronesians, right? The indigenous people of Southeast Asia that moved into Polynesia a long time ago, who essentially are ancestors that became Hawaiians when they came to Hawaii. But you also see, like, even the gods are described as immigrants or migrants. And so you have, like, Kane and Kanaloa came from Kahiki. And they toured the islands, poking springs to go drink awa everywhere. And they would come up. They would go in, like, the Waiakeakua story in Manoa. Kane and Kanaloa went into the back valley to Waiakeakua. And they saw mo'o there. And I guess the interpretation is the mo'o were here first, you know, these women symbolizing what they symbolize, and Kane and Kanaloa falling in love with them or chasing them and stuff. So even Pele is described as a kua malahini, and she came from Kahiki, right, which is southern islands or any foreign place, carrying her sister in an egg. And you know, her brother, Komoholi'i, the shark, guiding the canoe. And so it's really interesting when you think about migration in that respect, because Hawaiians, I mean, they see even their gods are from other places. And it's really different now when you look at the world now, which is very much nationality-based, right, which itself is a political construction in like the 1700s or whatever. So what is, and really therefore I think the Hawaiians talk about who does it best and who provides the best life. And it's touchy when you get into modern day, and it's on both sides. I think one side of the political spectrum, you have people that embrace, you know, at a national level, immigration and an open society and tolerance and all this stuff. But in our little pocket, some of those very same people, you know, they say colonizers can never be local, you know, Hawaii, you know, all this stuff. And I agree. It's different in Hawaii because you have this political classification of Native Hawaiians, and they have certain rights that are protected and need to be protected. And we've talked about this before. I don't like the term Native Hawaiian, because that assumes there's a non-native Hawaiian. So I just use Hawaiian, because we all know where we come from and who our parents are. And but in any event, if you make Hawaii a nation, well, then you have to have Hawaiian nationality. This is all before, you know, pre-contact, there was no Hawaiian nation. There were kings and god chiefs, and they kind of controlled the area they controlled supremely. And so it's this kind of interesting mix. But culturally, I think, going back, Hawaiians acknowledged and embraced foreigners and those from Kahiki they would worship some of them. They'd turn them into gods too. And, you know, you have the gods all lived other places, Kanehunamoku, all these magic islands that were beyond, you know, floating islands that were beyond the horizon. So this concept of other places and immigration, it was much more contextualized and part of society than I think it's kind of a viewed now, you know.
Yeah, I can think of a lot of situations right now globally where people are trying to take over, you know, take over a nation, take over a country, take back a country, create a bigger country, be more powerful. But the origin of us mixing the pot, mixing together, was all, I don't want to use the word amenable, but it was all, it was so much easier and so much more friendly. I mean, they were invited, many of them. And because, I mean, I don't know what the first immigrants to Hawaii thought of our kings, of our ali'i, and of the god status that we gave them. I have no way to know that. But I can imagine that they certainly saw them as in a position of power. They certainly saw them in a position of offering them an opportunity. Clearly, they came because things weren't so hot where they were. And they saw it as an opportunity to improve their situation. I mean, why would they have taken that journey otherwise? There had to be, you know, an advantage. And in my era, it was always money. You know, you come on contract and you work hard. In the generation before me, you know, then they were allowed to bring in picture brides and create families and so forth. And some of the stalwart family lines in Hawaii are of that heritage, right? You know, you think of just politics, you know. Look at the faces in our legislature. Look at the faces in our legislature. This time of year, I watch the ledge a lot because they can do stupid stuff if you don't pay attention. And it's an opportunity for all of us to, you know, have a say thank you, no thank you, or at least have the opportunity. But it's certainly an opportunity nowadays. Man, I am so grateful for YouTube. I cannot say I should be selling stock in YouTube. I'm just, because you can watch it today and you can watch it, you know, later you can repeat it. If you just tuned in, this is Pilikia Opono and this is KKCR, our Kauai community radio station. And I am Maka'ala and I am talking with Mauna Kea Trask. And we freewheel it. If you'd like to call 808-826-7771. I freewheel it. I really should edit that. Mauna actually reads stuff, and he actually knows stuff. I just kind of go by the seat of my pants here. Representing the common community, and often the uneducated, illiterate voice of what some of us think, but it's coming up again. You know, this immigration thing is hot right now. And there was an interview this morning on the radio with one of our federal congressmen who is suggesting that all of these immigration officers, Homeland Security, whatever you want to call them, have QR codes on their uniforms. They don't want their names. Okay, fine. You don't have to put your name, but a QR code. And we'll scan you with our cell phone and we'll find out who you are and who you work for and what you're doing. That's kind of cool. I think I kind of like that idea. But of course, you have to get pretty close to them to scan the QR code. I'm not sure how they would feel about that. But they're all over the immigrants. What's happening right now, as we speak on Kauai, just little Kauai in the middle of the deep blue sea, they're flying people in to capture, to get people who haven't followed every little process, and some who have, to make sure that they're in this country legally, because there is a process. And if you don't follow the process, then apparently, you know, you're bad, you're wrong. Some of it is, it's not an easy process, and some of it is, they just don't know. You know, if you can walk across a border, you can swim across a border. But they may not even recognize borders. But a lot of the people that I'm seeing on the news, the media, that are being held, and most are eventually let go, but are being held, are our service workers. There are restaurant workers. There are laundry people. There are field workers. There are food producers. These are key people in our society, and I'm assuming that there is a parallel there to way back then. Like you say, they were brought in to help, to provide the labor, to do a job. They weren't just wandering around the Pacific and landed in Hawaii and said, this is a good place, I'll make this home. They were actually solicited. Is that an immigrant? It's somebody coming from a different country, somebody not necessarily running away from something bad where they came from. Is that an immigrant? Somebody that we said, please come because we need your help? You know, the different cultures, the different lifestyles. Does it make our lives richer? Does it help us to work together? Does it help us to get more done? Does it make us more productive? Does it help our economy? Does it do all of those things? Most often, the one real separation I see, even in Hawaii, is in the churches. Because the Oriental religions still tend to worship in their own places and in their own ways, and Hawaiians in their own places and in their own ways, and Haoles in their own places and in their own ways. And it's not cut and dried, but it is a line of demarcation. So it's important if you're an immigrant to remember your roots, to remember where you came from, and to teach your children about your heritage. This program that the Haole Initiative is doing right now is really valuable for that. How many Chinese live in Hanalei? It's amazing! And yes, it's Qingyang, but it's a lot of others too. And the role they played in the development of the community, and where some of them have gone, because they're not all around anymore on the North Shore. Certainly some, but if you look around at the faces, just sit in the middle of Hanalei for an hour, find a chair and sit down and watch. Other than the contemporary tourists, you see the faces of all kinds of people from all over the world that live here and work here, and a lot of people came of their own accord, wanting a better opportunity. So a lot of immigration it's not going so well where I'm from. I'm hearing stories of it's better over there, grass is greener kind of thing.
I think it's interesting. It's really political, right? And it's race. And there's political also in the racist sense. Because like you said, if right now, you know, the president's wife is not seen as an immigrant, although she's totally an immigrant. Or Russia or whatever. Yeah. Yeah. But the Honduran is, or, you know, the Mexican is. I don't know anything about that. But I do think a couple concepts that I think are valuable in this discussion are, I think it was Kalakaua, he said ho'ulahui, which is build a nation, right? Make more Hawaiians. Because the Hawaiians, again, were so decimated by disease, and that we were encouraged by royal you know, encouragement to marry out, make more Hawaiians. I mean, Princess Kaʻiulani was half Scottish. Her dad was full-on Scottish, right? Samuel Cleghorn. No one's going to say Princess Kaʻiulani wasn't Hawaiian or was somehow less. Mary Kavenapukui, her dad was from Massachusetts, Wiggins or Higgins or something. Henry Nathaniel Wiggin. And so you have these, and no one's going to say she isn't. You can't take away her shine because her dad was from Salem. So I think that right now, but when you talk, when you get into, and this is the history of the politics of immigration in the United States, you get to, like, quotas and favoring people from Northern Europe and not from Southern Europe, and whatever the thing, Irish, absolutely not, right, for some reason, which I always thought was odd, but whatever. And so you have these really interesting takes and opinions and political positions in history that have, you know, sometimes long-reaching effects, sometimes not. I mean, Irish are encouraged to apply for jobs now, but at one point that was like the most common sign in New York or Boston or whatever. So I think a lot of people have gone through it, but in Hawaii, there was this sense of, you come in, and it was only those immigrants, and I count missionaries as immigrants, at the top, and then some of the higher ranking people, you know, like Portuguese were the brought over to be Lunas, right? They came over to run the plantations. And so they kind of stuck to themselves. Chinese totally integrated into Hawaii. Like you said, in Hanalei, I mean, you'll see some people that you can recognize as Chinese, but most every Hawaiian up there got some Chinese or another. Mm-hmm. That's where I get my Chinese from, is from when I'm assuming, right, from that area. And so you have these kind of, and you're right, it is about a better life, and not only where you come from, but if you establish yourself and you contribute. And I think that's the main, that's how Hawaiians really looked at it, was what did you bring to Hawaii? How did you improve society? You know, did you integrate? Because you get a lot of these post-migrations. It's funny, like, when I went to, after Hurricane, like, I went to high school, right? Mid-Pact and Kamehameha boarded. So I was kind of out. And then I went to undergrad for a bunch of years. So I was pretty much away from Kauai, except for summers, for about 10 years. And then when I was able to get back to Kauai in about 2008, 2010, I talk to a lot of people. I'd meet people and say, oh, you're from Kauai. Do you know so-and-so? And I swear I didn't know anybody on Kauai anymore. And it was because so many people had moved there, you know, after the hurricane in the mid to late 90s or early 2000s. And it didn't seem like that migration of people really got into the local culture. Like, they're kind of older, came to retire, versus in the 70s when the surfers came. You know, I mean, that's who we went to school with, right? You had all these people come in, and we all went to school together. We all go to the beach together, and you had all this stuff. But it seems like Kauai got a little more stratified, or there were more silos there. The plantations were gone, so you didn't have, you know, going back to what you said about the plantations, I understand that the plantation owners wanted to keep people separate for political purposes, largely to prohibit unions from organizing. But they would nonetheless talk to each other, and they have to interact, and that's where you got Pigeon from. And you kind of created this culture. Once the plantations left, you didn't really have that central location of interaction and work. And then, like you said, when the hotels really started coming off after Ag effectively died, they bring in a lot of Filipinos, which is the Philippines' biggest export is labor throughout the world. And I remember once I was in trial, and the judge, we're going through voir dire picking jury, and one of the things they ask you is English your first language? And this woman said, no. You know, what is your first language? Filipino, or Ilocano, I think. And there was a bunch of questions on, well, what do you watch? You know, what do you speak at work? Ilocano. What do you watch on TV? Ilocano. What do you listen to radio? And this, and there's a whole, you can live as a Filipino on Kauai, or at one point you could, and really not have any interaction with other cultures necessarily.
And yeah, I think that's still true. I mean, I grew up with, like I said, with the Filipino nanny, and she was not Ilocano, she was Tagalog. But I'm going to leave this show, and I'm going to go down to Hanalei, and I'm going to go into Big Save and see what get and buy some produce, etc. And they're all speaking Ilocano around me, and I don't know it. And I fluctuate. Sometimes it annoys because I don't understand, you know, what they're talking about, what's going on. So sometimes it's, you know, annoying. But most of the time I realize that that is their best and easiest and fastest way to communicate. They can turn and speak to me in English if pressured, but for efficiency's sake and for, you know, daytime commerce, you know, and their job, they're all speaking Ilocano. And I remember having the thought a while back, because at first it kind of bugged me, and then I realized that's their culture. That's who they are. And I think that they're told by management that they should be speaking English, because Howleys get offended or confused or whatever. Laura has something she'd like to add.
I've heard that there's going to be ear pods that automatically translate.
That's going to bend their life.
The nail techs are going to, you know, we'll be able to understand what they're talking about when they're doing our nails. Like a Seinfeld episode.
Boy, when the Thai nail techs can understand, when we can understand the Thai nail techs, besides you get girlfriend, besides that one. Oh, that's going to be really interesting, because I know they're talking stink about me. Look at that toe. What's she doing with that toe? But I'll bet you a dollar to a donut they're not. I'll bet you they're just talking about their everyday life and whether somebody's got a ride and what they're going to have for lunch and who's going to go to the store for dinner. And
I don't know, man. When I used to run kayak tours, we would talk bad about some of the tourists in the sickest stage. We just like look at each other, make nods, and like move our heads. But, you know, it's funny. Brenda's to the point. Like, I don't think that it is. I mean, you know, we're in Hawaii, and the language Hawaii is Hawaiian, and
officially,
it's coming back. But I mean, it definitely wasn't. You know, it's getting more popular, which is great. But I mean, I think it's hard pressed for any. And it's, I think that's the there is a degree of irony and hypocrisy in this topic and discussion, because I always thought it's really funny let's get hyper political. I watched the Super Bowl this past weekend.
And, oh yes, know, wasn't that interesting?
Horrible. Yeah, horrible game. Great halftime show. Just objectively, I thought it was much better than Kendrick Lamar dancing.
Well, how's your Spanish?
Dissing Drake. my Spanish, you know, if Bad Bunny was yelling at me to like my mom used to, I probably would understand better. But I just thought it was cool. Like at one point, he says all the Americas. Like he starts at Argentina. Yeah. He's like Argentina, Peru, Brazil, blah 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 blah, all the way up to Canada, and then you get the sense like, wow, most of America is Latino.
Yeah.
And you always think, you know, America is the United States is the only one that claims America, and you know, I mean, obviously, I think everyone thinks that to a certain degree, but you know, I was talking to someone close with me, and they were kind of saying, yeah, it's up to, you know, they had a differing opinion on the halftime show. And I said, well, just from a market perspective, like NFL wants to expand its reach to get that Latino dollar because they're getting clobbered by soccer, right? Or, you know,
yeah,
real football. And so, and then they're like, oh yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, look at where the game was. Look at where the game was. I mean, the game is in Santa Clara. The game is,
yeah, California.
There's more of them than anybody else in California.
It's kind of hard to hate on immigrants going to your state when your state is a Spanish name. I mean, I used to be part of Mexico.
Yeah,
I've had people ask me like, you know, because my mom is from Tucson. I'm Mexican heritage, and they're like, oh, you know, when did your parents or grandparents, whatever, come to the United States? And I honestly, I was like, I think they were always there. I think the line moved south of them because they were in northern Mexico, right? Like,
yeah,
and they're right on the border.
Well, there wasn't much of a line, you know.
Yeah, and it didn't really. And this is really interesting. Like, it doesn't really get the line really doesn't develop until the mid 20th century when you have all these political kind of racial policies and all this stuff. And I think that, you know, now you made another good point, but I've forgotten where I was going with this.
You forgot one of my good points? Oh, dang, I make so few of them. But I'll tell you, in California, and this was at least 15 years ago, because I go back periodically because I went to school there and I have kids there and stuff. And I go back, and when my grandkids were little and we go into McDonald's, they call your order out in Spanish before they call it out in English. And they still do that. And the reason for that is that's who's in the room. That's who the customer base is. They do get it. They will call it in English, but you got to wait. And it has an interesting effect on you. When, you know, not me particularly, because I was raised around, you know, five different cultures pretty thickly. But for Holly's living in affluent northern Marin County, to have to sit and wait to hear for their English order call out is, I don't think they take it well. And I don't think they take it well that others are voting. And of course, the man who shall not be named, who's tearing down our DC buildings left and right, his response was, you know, he couldn't understand a thing anybody said, and he thought that the dancing was disgusting. And that shows a lack of exposure to me. Of course, it's ignorance, but it shows a lack of experience and exposure. He doesn't speak proudly of his wife's heritage. He speaks how proud he is of her English. And you know, I remember her explaining once that her son speaks with an accent because he was mostly around her. And that made sense to me. But here's this, you know, this kid who's going to grow up in that environment and that sort of dynasty with a, what is she? Is she Czech? Is she Yugoslavian? Whatever Melania is. And it doesn't matter to me. It doesn't matter to me. I speak a little Spanish, I speak a little French, so if that's that, then I can, you know, I can probably get myself in and out of trouble. At least I can find the bathroom most of the time. But it's interesting. It really has to do with what's happening in the world, how we feel about that. We always welcomed, the Hawaiians welcomed other people, right? That was the philosophy. And Americans welcomed other people. We asked them to come. We asked them to help. We asked them to do the work we didn't want to do. And now they're persona non grata. That's just plain racist. That's just plain racist. I don't have any other word for it. But like you just said, you know that you have Mexican. You know that you have Chinese. I've got, you know, 75% of me is mutt, man. I've got everything in the world. My husband, on the other hand, is 100% Hawaiian, but he doesn't speak Hawaiian. He can't understand it, and he gets his feelings hurt, and he gets very, very, very uncomfortable when the young people with whom we associate all speak Hawaiian. Really, our kids are really, they're getting there, and our grandkids certainly are getting there.
It's really like us. It's like that old Dr. Seuss Nietzsche's book, right? And because, and you get, but then, you know, Aaron tells me some stuff in UH. There, within that Hawaiian-speaking community, there are lines that we have no idea of. You know, and famously, the Robinsons hold down the oldest type of Hawaiian, the Niihau Kauai Hawaiian.
Yes.
And that, they're like, I mean, no kina, no kahako. They just rip.
They didn't need them. They didn't need them. They knew from context. I said this to somebody the other day. They said, well, why isn't there an okina there? And I said, because if you understood what the name, well, what the word is in the context within which it's being used, you didn't need it. You knew whether it was there or not. And it still cracks me up when people put an okina before a consonant, because you're just going to choke to death if you try to do that. But they're trying, right?
So yeah, it's good.
Even the people that say things incorrectly, I'm still, you know, my personality, I'm still searching for a nice way to say, you know, this is how that's said, because, you know, it's not my first instinct. But I think in order to get along, you know, the more we travel in space, the more we look back at this little blue ball, we should, and I don't like to go to shoulds, but it seems to me that a natural process of that would be to realize how small, how finite, how fragile, and how much we are all in this together, folks, and to be able to communicate. It is something, I have young Hawaiian people around me a lot, and they just assume that I can speak, that I can understand. And I'll pick out a word every, you know, 8, 9, 10 words, and sometimes it's enough for me to get the gist. But most often I flip back to my pidgin and try to let them know that way that I really don't understand. And they don't know. They don't know. Because Tutu spoke Hawaiian. They don't understand why you don't. My Tutu spoke Hawaiian. I didn't understand. I didn't know why. I did, you know. My husband's mother spoke to him in Hawaiian. But if he responded in Hawaiian, she slapped him. Because she wanted him to assimilate.
And there was reasons for it. And we forget them now. But I mean, I think, and just to kind of tie it up, I think a lot of this stuff are red herrings. You know, they're just pointless. They're like culture war stuff. It's really political. And like going back to what you said about, you know, at the federal level, immigration policy, I mean, a lot of people have strong opinions unless you're Cuban and you vote a certain way. Then they're all about it, right? And
yes.
So it really comes down to support in politics. I think that's the foundation of most racial policy. Because we're all individually, we have our prejudices and biases. But as far as systemic goes, that's a higher level.
Yes.
And I really think it comes down to acknowledging and venerating your own individual ancestors. Like, I always find it kind of interesting when people claim whether Hawaiian, you know, claim Hawaiian or not Hawaiian, or claim whatever and not be it, that their kupuna and aumakua are looking at them going, wow, man, you know, like, why would you, after all we did for you, and you're saying that you're not one of us? Like, that's odd to me. And I don't think that there's really a value, correctly a value attributed to your heritage. That's just your heritage. It is what it is. It's where you come
it's
from.
What you make
important.
Of it.
Yeah. It's what you do. And I think it's just, are you in the canoe or are you out of the canoe? If you're in the canoe, are you paddling or not? If you're paddling, are you carrying your weight? Are you blending in? Are you paddling with everybody? Or are you, you know, you're on the wrong side. You're going every other. Or you're just dragging the boat. Like, if you're dragging the boat, you don't belong in the boat. But if you do, and I've paddled, you know, watching Uncle Dirge and Uncle Rick and all my paddling coaches, they would, heritage didn't matter. Color didn't matter.
No, if you were good, paddling? Good. Yeah.
Yeah. That's why I love that sport. And then, you know, that's why I love six man better than one man, because it takes that many people doing different things together. That's the best.
Yeah.
And that's the truth. And I think that's the way Hawaiians looked at this issue. Because obviously, if you didn't sit, like if you came over and they treated you well in 1778, and then you came back and you were a little high-handed, and you got hurt because we took one of your dinghies and took some nails out of it, and you tried to take our king, well, we're gonna kill you.
and we did.
Yeah. And so at one point, Captain Cook was a good immigrant, and then he wasn't. And so, you know, that's kind of, and again, I think largely, maybe not political, but I those are kind of just the real considerations of it. But ultimately, I don't think it was really, you know, we all are a mix. And even what it means to be 100% Hawaiian is an interesting question.
Yeah.
Because you can be 100% pre-1778, but then up until post-1778. But before that, I mean, what does that mean, right? How do we draw the lines when there's no writing, there's no history?
Yeah. Thank you, Mauna. We're gonna stop a little bit early this morning because our engineer and provider of all things electronic over here, Laura, has a commitment that she needs to get to, and you have a work day ahead of you, and I have a work day ahead of me. And today we need to stop a little bit earlier, so we're going to mahalo Laura and mahalo you and mahalo KKCR for existing, for its very existence. We got a bunch of immigrants work up here, so thank you so much, Mauna, for taking this time. We know you have a busy day, and mahalo KKCR for providing this opportunity. Mahalo, and we'll see you next month, the second Wednesday at 7 a.m.